I opened the Trinity Bible Fellowship Church preaching calendar at the beginning of the year by preaching on Philemon, the third shortest book of the Bible. And I know you've all been on the edge of your seats all year wondering, what about the two shorter books? What do they have to say? So today I'm coming back with 2nd and 3rd John to talk about them. I'm going to attempt to do two things today that I have never before seen done in a church on a Sunday morning. The first, before your very eyes, I will attempt to preach two entire books of the Bible in a single sermon. The second thing that is more surprising, and I polled about 100 years of pastoral experience, and only one person believed they'd ever done this, I have never before heard any preaching from 2nd or 3rd John. Now, think long and hard for just a moment, and you may think that's also true. In fact, if I went around with a microphone and I said, hey, what's your favorite verse from John? You might hesitate for a second and say, whoo, I don't know. Now, why is that? Well, 2nd and 3rd John, I've come to think, are a little bit like the storage closets in the church. Everybody knows where they are. They're small. You assume they hold something important, but you really never go in there unless somebody specifically asks you to, okay? And I wondered, why do we sort of neglect two entire books of the New Testament? I think there are four pretty quick reasons. One, they're overshadowed by their big brother. 1 John's got a lot to say, and so we spend a lot of time there, and we think about it there. The second reason is they are small. They're so small. How small are they? They're so small that if you took them out of the Bible, combined them into a single book, and put them back in, they'd still be the fourth shortest book of the Bible. They are both shorter, each individually shorter, than the Gettysburg Address. 2nd and 3rd John are some of the shortest chapters in the Bible. If you added them to another book of the Bible, they'd be the shortest chapters of most of the books of the Bible. And this is all before we consider that 2nd and 3rd John are about half greetings and salutations. Hello, goodbye. If you take those out, we're down to something even smaller, okay? I think there's another reason that we find these to be fairly, that we ignore them a lot, and that's that 2nd John and 3rd John both cover ground that other books cover, maybe in a little bit more depth. They're quick hits on a lot of things you could find a lot more detail on somewhere else. As we'll see in a moment, 2nd John is repetitive to some extent of 1 John chapter 2. And if I'm allowed to say this about books of the Bible, hear me out, don't throw anything yet, they feel almost incomplete. They seem to reference things outside of themselves, conversations that are going to happen in the future, things that someone has already read. They feel like half of a text message thread. Now, when Mark Stabilefsky passed away earlier this year, one of the first things I did is I went back and read my texts with him. Because your text messages with somebody are a very weird picture of your relationship with them. And Mark's texts to me, if you just read his side, they were loving, they were funny, they were quirky, they were Mark. And they contained things like, hey, I think that thing you said in Sunday school isn't quite right, and here's why. Or, here's that Bible verse I was looking for, and I couldn't remember the reference. I had to go home and look it up. And yeah, I see your question there. Let me talk to you on Sunday in person when I see you about it. 2nd and 3rd John are a little hard to gather because, along with Philemon, these three books are unique in the New Testament. They're the only books written to private Christians. They're not written to pastors. They're not written to a church. They're not apparently written to elders. They are written to people who are already converted, already persuaded, already walking with God, and they're meant to quickly reference things that he believes these recipients know. Well, the fourth reason that I think that sometimes we don't spend a lot of time in these is that these deal with first century rather than first world problems. 2nd and 3rd John have a lot to do with when you should welcome roving itinerant preachers into your home. Not something you have likely ever really struggled over, not a moral quandary we're real familiar with. But of course, all scripture is God-breathed and all of it is effective for us to understand something. God, in his wisdom, put these in here for a reason. So today, I want to try to run through these and see what we can learn from 2nd and 3rd John. Both of them begin with the same words, the elder, the elder. If any of our elders got up here and said, hi, I'm the elder, we'd say, okay, Pastor Jerry, calm down, right? We'd say, wait a second, hold on. So think about what kind of authority it takes for John to say the elder. John is apparently the man who truly needs no introduction. He just says the elder, and he expects you'll know who he is. John is unique among the apostles of Jesus Christ. He's the only one who had an eyewitness seat to all of first century church history. Okay. Now, we believe that 2nd and 3rd John were written somewhere between 85 and 100 AD at the close of the first century. John, near the end of his life, is writing. Keep in mind, John was a disciple. He tells us in his own unique way in John chapter 1, he was a disciple of John the Baptist. Before Jesus appears on the scene, John was out traveling with the last of the Old Testament prophets. Like a comic book character ripped from the wrong universe and put into a different one, John the Baptist shows up saying the Messiah is about to come. We need to bathe ourselves and wash ourselves to prepare. John the Baptist was preparing John's heart for the disciple for Jesus, to be a disciple of Jesus before he ever appeared. And then when he says, look, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world, it's John who goes out with his brother and they follow him. And then, as Pastor Dan talked last week, it's Peter, James, and John who have this close relationship amongst the disciples with Jesus. They're there on the Mount of Transfiguration. They're there in the Garden of Gethsemane. They're at all of the important moments of Jesus' ministry. And John is the only disciple who makes it to the cross to watch Jesus die. He's the first of the disciples to rush to the tomb and look inside when he hears that it's empty. And now, John has had the dubious privilege of watching all of his friends, all the other disciples, lose their lives in martyrdom for Christ. And at this point, history tells us, if it's to be believed, there's strong tradition that they've tried to kill John a few times. John can say in the words of Elijah, I'm the only one left, and they're trying to kill me too. He is the elder. And so he writes from a unique and powerful perspective, embodying all of that personal experience with Jesus. The elder to the elect lady and her children. Now, 2 John is unique in the Bible and unique in the New Testament, I should say. It's the only New Testament book that has no proper names other than Jesus. The elder to the elect lady and her children. We don't know who the elect lady is. Some have suggested this is written at a time of persecution, that John didn't want to have this letter intercepted and give the name of another believer. That's possible. It's possible he wrote it to a church, and this is a metaphor, the elect lady and her children, Trinity Bible Fellowship Church and its members, maybe. It's also possible, and I think the simplest explanation is the best, this is just a lady that he's writing to, in which case, this is the only book of the Bible addressed entirely to a woman. He writes to the elect lady and her children, whom I love in truth, and not only I, but also all who know the truth, because of the truth that will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us in truth and love. You're getting the hint here a little bit. He's writing about truth. He is worried about people wandering from the truth. And I've got to imagine that John, by this time in his life, had to be frustrated. He had to be tired. He had to feel like a guy walking through a swamp, smacking mosquitoes off of him. At this point, John is writing against the background of many heresies. He's getting old, and he's probably wondering, will the next generation of the church survive without the eyewitness of the last apostle? He writes to her and he says, I want you to know the thing that keeps us strong is truth. I love you in truth. I love you along with all those who know the truth. I love you because of the truth. It's truth that enables love. Now, this is where I feel like these are almost like text messages. Reading between the lines, you can sense that this lady is a loving person. And he's writing to let her know our love, though, is enabled by truth. Love doesn't mean anything without truth. You want to love the people in your life, your church, your family, your community. The way you do it is by walking in truth. I love you because of the truth that abides in us and will be with us forever. Grace, mercy, and peace will be with us, he promises. Most of the New Testament letters begin with a prayer that they be with us. John says, I know from personal experience, grace, mercy, and peace, I can tell you, they will be with us no matter what we go through. Now notice who they're from God the Father. And this is a phrase we don't see anywhere else in the Bible. From Jesus Christ, the Father's Son. Seems odd, oddly written. From God the Father and Jesus Christ, the Father's Son. You've heard this expression? I am my Father's Son. Meaning, I can explain all my weird quirks, just look at my dad. Okay? John is writing lovingly to somebody who's already converted and persuaded and reminding her the things that are weird about Jesus are weird because he's just like his father. The things that are beautiful about Jesus are beautiful because he's just like his father. Why would John take time to remind us of this? Well, one of the characteristics of the Gnostic heresy that was becoming dominant in the last part of the first century was people saying, well, God the Father was this mean, nasty, whatever, and Jesus was the loving one who came to kind of keep us away from the Father. And John, continually in his letters, he beats this down. He keeps reminding us our fellowship is with the Father and with his Son, Jesus Christ. If you have the Father, you have the Son. He says, you cannot split the atom. Okay, the Trinity is not a buffet where you get to go in and pick which one you like and decide which sides you want to accompany it. If you want the Son, you got to have the Father. If you want the Father, you got to have the Son. He is his Father's Son. He's just like him. He says these will be with us in truth and love because truth and love are the soil out of which all of the other characteristics of Christian doctrine grow. He goes on to say, I rejoiced greatly to find some of your children walking in the truth. Sounds almost like he's suggesting some of them are not walking in the truth, but more likely because he's writing to the lady and her children, and he's saying, I found some of your children walking in the truth. He's just met some of her kids, adult kids somewhere, and writing back and saying to the rest of them, I want you to know I was delighted to find some of your kids walking in the truth. And now, he says, I ask you, dear lady, not as though I were writing you a new commandment, but one which we have had from the beginning, that we love one another. And this is love, that we walk according to his commandments. This is the commandment, just as you heard from the beginning, that you should walk in it. And I think this is sometimes where we get a little lost, because John writes in an almost circular fashion. It's a little bit confusing for us in a Western mindset. And this is something that he's already said in 1 John 2 in more depth. So a few things occur to me from reading this. The first is, it seems he believes you are already familiar with 1 John 2. He thinks this lady already knows the teaching of 1 John. Maybe it's a letter that she's already read, or it's a sermon he's preached in front of her. But he goes back to this, and he does a three-part process here. He says, this is the commandment. It's not new. It's one, that we love one another. Okay, what's love? Well, love is two, that we walk according to his commandments. And three, you ask, what is the commandment? The commandment is that you walk in the commandment. John is intentionally tying together, almost humorously, these three things and saying they cannot be separated. Do not buy it when anybody comes to you and says, well, I don't want to speak the truth to that person because it might not be loving. Don't buy it if somebody says, well, I don't know, that doesn't seem like a kind thing to do, to reject someone over Christian doctrine. And he says, there is no such thing as loving untruth. There is no such thing as truthful unlovingness. They are absolutely intertwined in a way that they cannot be separated. And just as the Trinity can't be pulled apart, so truth and love are united. And then he says, verse 7, for many deceivers. Now, this is all one verse. Everything we just read is all one, I should say one sentence. All this about the commandment and the love, these being united. The reason we have to follow this is because many deceivers, like cockroaches, have gone out into the world. You flip the light of the truth on and they go scurrying. Those who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Such a one is the deceiver and the Antichrist. Can't think of much stronger language that John can put on this. Here's your friendly reminder that the word Antichrist never appears in Revelation where you expect to find it, which John wrote. Okay? The Antichrist never shows up in Revelation, or at least the word doesn't. John uses the word four times, three times in 1 John and once here. What he says is, don't worry about the Antichrist you've heard about at the end of time. Worry about the one that's here now. And that's anybody running around claiming that they are a Christian teacher, but who denies the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. He says at the center, at the core of Christian doctrine is the incarnation that we talked about last week. This is a Christmas book. In other words, this is a Christmas movie. Okay, 2 John. It says, the way you understand if somebody's telling the truth is that they confess that Jesus Christ came in the flesh. What does it mean to confess? When a police officer's in an interrogation room with somebody and he's saying, "Come on, man, confess." What is he asking for? Is he saying, "Make up a story? Tell me a story. Tell me your opinion. Tell me your truth." No. He's saying, "Look, I've shown you all the evidence that disagrees with all the silly stories you told me. Give it up and confess. Say in conjunction with all of the evidence what is true." People who do not confess the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh, they are not worth, John says, the waste of time. This person's a deceiver. It's the opposite of the truth, a deceiver, and the Antichrist. They are attempting to replace Christ with their own doctrine. And he says, watch yourselves. Now, this plural word kind of throws people off. People say maybe this is why he's writing to a church, plural. But I actually think he's writing to the dear lady. I think he's saying, because he's about to tell her, don't welcome these people into your home who are teaching this false doctrine. He says, watch yourselves. I think what he's saying is, I'm not as much worried about you. I'm worried about how you supporting these false teachers is going to affect everybody around you. Don't just watch yourself, dear lady. Watch yourselves. Watch the people around you so that you may not lose what we have worked for. What a strange phrase. John says, I have some investment in all of this. I have worked hard, you have worked hard, we have worked hard to build the church. I don't want us to lose what we have worked for by letting in a little bit of error. A little bit of heresy can ruin the whole thing. It'll destroy it all. We don't want to lose what we've worked for. We want a full reward from God. In verse 9, he goes on to say, everyone who goes on ahead, and I love that phrase, everyone who goes on ahead and does not abide in the teaching of Christ does not have God. Whoever abides in the teaching has both the Father and the Son. There it is again. You'll have both of them or neither. If anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him. What does it mean to go on ahead? Isn't this the allure of false doctrine? It's, well, you know, you can get on ahead. You don't have to stay in what the Bible teaches. There's something exciting, something new, something you never heard. And this begins to circle back to something subtle that John has already said. He said, I'm not writing you a new command. John almost says right up front, I want to be really clear. What I'm going to write to you is going to be boring, dull, and something you've heard before. And he goes on to repeat something he said before. It's the give me that old time religion, John says. When people come to you and they say, hey, I've got something exciting. We're going to now step out beyond the Bible into the realm of the spirit or whatever they're promising you. He says, don't do it. Don't buy it. Don't eat it. That's never the right thing. I want the old commandments. I want the things you've heard from the beginning. Abide in the teaching of Christ. Don't go out on ahead. There's nothing to get ahead to. You abide in the teaching. You stay here. You dwell here. People sometimes say about church, oh, I don't know if I need to go to church. I've heard it all before. Great. Abide. It's not just about learning something new. Now look, I hope that today I'll say something about 2nd or 3rd John that you've never heard or thought of before. I hope so. But it'll be new to you, not new to the church. It won't be some new doctrine. I don't hope to innovate anything today. All of us can learn and grow. We're all learning new things, but John says the way you measure a teaching is by how it connects to the old commandments that we have already received. We've already got the doctrine, he says, at the end of the first century. Now we've got to abide in it. We've got to grow in it. We've got to send our roots deep into the soil of truth. That's what we should be trying to do from here. Here he says, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, what teaching? Well, we can work our way backward. It says, whoever abides in the teaching. Well, what teaching? Before that, you see the teaching of Christ, right? The teaching we're talking about is the teaching of Christ, and that's the command you've had from the beginning. It's all one thing running through this, and that is the coming of Jesus Christ in the flesh. Christ, God being made man at the cross, that's where heaven meets earth. That's where all of this comes together, is in the human that Jesus was and what he did for us on the cross. He says in verse 10, if anyone comes to you and does not bring this teaching, do not receive him into your house. And do not give him any greeting. For whoever greets him takes part in his wicked works. Now this command of the Bible, this command of God, never makes it onto the cool commands of God posters, right? It's not like, you know, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Love one another. Don't welcome traveling itinerant preachers who don't, believe in the incarnation. Right? It's not on the welcome mats. You know, Crossway doesn't say a welcome unless you deny the coming of Jesus in the... So this is a command that actually shocks us. And I think it actually gets worse upon further inspection. Because in the ancient world, if you were traveling, let's say from, I don't know, Ephesus to Illyricum or whatever, if you're traveling across the known world of the Mediterranean at the time, there weren't hotels. There weren't places to stay. If you went out and appeared in some foreign city where you didn't know the culture and didn't know the language and didn't know anything to preach in a place, the only place you had to stay was with somebody who somebody said they knew and said would take you in. And John is saying to this lady, if somebody shows up and they're expecting your hospitality because it's been promised to them by somebody who knew you, and they show up and they do the night service before they come over and they come to the night service and they deny the incarnation at that night service, walk up to them at the end and say, hey, I don't know where you're sleeping tonight, but it's not under my roof, okay? I don't know where you're eating, but it's not at my house. I don't feed the heretics. And then just walk out. Don't greet them. Don't say anything nice to them. Don't say good luck. Just walk out on them. In the ancient world, this was actually, there were customs about ways that you would know who you could stay with. And there were these things called guest tokens or hospitality tokens. And this is actually one on the screen that they've found. This is actually an example of one. And they're almost like those old like friendship things that used to break apart. And each of you would take one and they'd go together or whatever. This is how people who wouldn't see each other for decades would know when they came back that they were who they still claimed to be. This was how if you'd stayed with somebody and they cared about you and said, come anytime, bring your family, you'd break one apart and give it to them. That way, if their kids showed up years later, you'd go, oh yeah, okay, you have a right to my hospitality. Notice what John says here. If anybody comes to you and they don't bring this teaching, if they're not carrying this teaching with them, this token, don't let them in, okay? The password is incarnation. When you go to check their bags, if the truth is not in it, don't let them in your house. The hospitality token is the truth of the teaching of Jesus Christ. Don't let them in your house and don't give them any greeting. This command, the more you dwell on it and meditate on it, it's shocking and stunning. Christians are known for their hospitality. In fact, it's in the list of requirements for elders that they should be hospitable. Hebrews 13 says we should welcome strangers. We should put them up in our homes. And here is John saying, well, you know, unless they deny the incarnation. So think about what he's saying. Why would John be so harsh? Well, what comes to mind for me is treason. Treason is defined as taking up arms against your country or giving aid and comfort to the enemies of your country. I believe John is saying this is treason to give aid and comfort to the enemies of God who are going around and actively deceiving others. I don't think John is saying don't welcome people into your home to eat with them and minister to them and teach them the word of God and try to convert them. He's saying people who are going around and deceiving, who are the spirit of Antichrist in this world, don't give them any support. Don't lift a finger to help them, because by doing so, you take part in their wicked works. In 1 John chapter 3, John writes that the reason that the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. In other words, if you deny the incarnation, if you deny that Jesus came to destroy the devil's work, you might as well just say you think Satan is still king. You might as well say the king doesn't exist. The incarnation is the whole thing. There is no way around accepting that you are a Christian but don't believe that Jesus has come in the flesh. Well, let's go to 3 John, and we'll come back to the endings at the end. 3 John, the elder, to the beloved Gaius, whom I love in truth. And there are multiple Gaii in the New Testament, but it does not appear that they are connected in any way. This is an individual who's lost to history other than this one book. Beloved, I pray that all may go well with you and you may be in good health as it goes well with your soul. And here it is, folks. We've come to that great patron saint Bible verse of crazy diet plans sold to gullible Christians under the name of Christ. If you turn on TBN at the wrong time of night or walk into a weird health food store, you might see this verse pitching some bizarre thing that you're supposed to take by tablet or whatever. This is a verse that's often misused, but we can't let the heretics have this verse because it's really important and it's powerful. For one thing, 3 John is the only book in the New Testament that begins with a physical rather than a spiritual greeting. This is unusual for John to say, I pray that you may be in health. I pray that you should prosper financially, reputationally, socially, in every way, just as your soul prospers. There's a lot to say about this, so let's just take it one at a time. For one thing, what an amazing thing that John basically says, you are in such good spiritual health, guys, that I'm not even going to waste my time praying about that. I'm just going to move on to the secondary stuff. I'm praying for your finances. What do you need, guys? I'm going to pray for all that stuff, because clearly, you're doing great spiritually. Second thing that's amazing to me is that John, in saying this, is embodying the biblical principle that man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. John knows more about him spiritually than he does in any other way. He knows that he's doing well spiritually. He doesn't know about all the other things. How many people can we say that about? That we know that they're spiritually doing well. We know their spiritual condition more than everything else. John is tuned into this guy's spiritual situation. But another thing that's really cool about this, in writing and saying this, is John is also emphasizing something that Gnosticism denied. Remember, Gnosticism said that the physical body is evil, that it's to be regretted, that the spirit is what we invest in. And John says, no, it's not. And John, writing to Guy, says, I pray that you're in good health. I pray that you're doing well physically, just as you are with your soul. But the thing that really rounds this out for me is thinking about, what would I think if John said to me, I pray that you do as well physically, financially, socially, as you're doing spiritually? Would you consider that a blessing if he said that to you today? What a challenge it is that Gaius can take this as a compliment. I hope that all of the things you spend most of your time caring about will rise to the level of your spirituality. For many of us, we might say, ooh, only that good? I hope maybe they'll do better, right? So here he is saying, your spiritual life is what you should prioritize, and in Gaius's case, what you have prioritized. I pray that it'll go as well with you physically and financially as it does spiritually. I have no greater joy than to hear that my children are walking in the truth. This is John saying that I have this paternal view of you. John apparently believes that the spiritual condition of those who he has ministered to. It's almost like his kids doing well. Notice what he says. He says, your reputation is preceding you in verse 2. I rejoiced greatly because the brothers came and testified to your truth, that you're walking in God's truth, that you've been reflecting the glory of God in what you do. People are talking about how you have blessed them. I imagine, once again, reading a little between the lines, that Gaius, for what we're going to see at the end of this letter, that he's tired. Gaius has been ministering and welcoming people into his home. In the ancient world, that didn't just mean, hey, here's the guest room. It sometimes meant defending them or getting involved in their problems while they were in town. It meant going out and introducing them to people. It was an obligation. Lena's grandmother, who passed away this year, her teta, was a pastor's wife in a little village in Lebanon for 30 years. And her husband had planted the only evangelical church in this little village outside of Sidon. And it was a great sacrifice to their family, their reputation, their family relationships, because this was not smiled upon. Part of the obligation that comes in that culture with being a pastor's family is that if people show up after church, you just feed them. People just come over. Laura, you'd love this. People just come over and you just feed them. They would just walk in, and she'd say, people would just show up unannounced that you didn't know were coming. And Lena would say, well, what would you do? And she'd say, well, we just add some more water to the soup. Just spread it a little further, right? Take what's yours, water it down, and give it away. That's how you made it through. And I can imagine that Gaius was tired of adding water to the soup. I can imagine there just had come a point where he's getting worn out. And John writes, this is going to be a letter of introduction of a traveling preacher named Demetrius at the end of it. He's writing, Demetrius shows up at his doorstep, and remember, in the ancient world, he didn't send a text ahead of time. He didn't say, hey, is it okay if Demetrius comes and hangs out at your house for a few days? Great, thank you. Okay, there's no email advance. Demetrius just shows up with a letter from John. And I think John had to imagine that at this point, Gaius is going, oh man. And he opens up the letter, and John begins with, I hope you're doing great. Physically, financially, because it's obvious you're doing great spiritually. And I want you to know that everybody who comes away from you talks about what a blessing you were to them. What high praise coming from an apostle. Well, he says, beloved, it's a faithful thing you do in all your efforts for these brothers, strangers as they are, people he did not know who he's housing, who testified to your love before the church. You will do well to send them on their journey in a manner worthy of God. Think about what that means. In a manner worthy of God, keep sending these people on. What you are doing is treating them in a manner worthy of the God that we serve. For they have gone out for the sake of the name. It's a fun fact, 3 John, unique in the New Testament, because it's the only one that does never mention Jesus by name. They went out for the sake of the name that Gaius knows so well, he doesn't even need to repeat it. They accept nothing from the Gentiles. Listen, the people I'm sending you, they can't get support anywhere else. If they come to the church and they're rejected, there is nobody else who's going to care for them. These are people who are flying in the face of what the culture teaches. They are carrying the burden of truth. We can't expect the pagans to pay their way. We can't expect the heretics to put them up in their homes. So it's us or nobody. Therefore, in verse 8, we ought to support people like these, that we may be fellow workers for the truth. You see how 2nd and 3rd John, I felt we had to preach them together because they're two sides of the same coin. Don't feed the heretics, but do welcome all of those who bring the teaching of Christ. He says we ought to help them. It's not optional. They're either bringing the teaching or they're not. And if they are bringing the teaching, we should do everything in our power to welcome them, to speed them on their way, to take care of them. And if we do that, the same reason we don't greet heretics, we don't greet the heretics because we don't want to bless them. We don't want to take part in their wicked works. We do greet those who carry the teaching of Christ so that we can be fellow workers in the truth. You want a piece of what they're doing? Welcome them. You know, I think this way about missionaries, and for us in the 21st century, this is more the way it is. It's maybe a little bit less about welcoming people in our homes and more about saying, do you like what Jordan Eicher is doing on college campuses? Do you ever look at somebody who's really doing something great, ministering to people, witnessing to kids, teaching them the Bible, growing people in their faith, and you look at it and you go, that's cool. You want a piece of that? Support it. That's how we do it. Do you like what Victory Valley is doing? How they're teaching kids the gospel, how they're teaching kids the Bible? It's pretty easy. You can have a piece of it, support it. You know, people buy stock in this country because they want the returns of what that company is doing. Wow, that company's really growing. I want shares in that. I want to share in how they're growing and exploding. The same thing should be true in ministry. We should be investing financially into things that we want a piece of. I want to take credit for what that person is doing. I want to take credit for how they're living their life for the gospel. I have written something to the church. I love this little phrase because it almost sounds like saying, I've written a little something, just a little something. I've written a little something, the apostle says, to the church. Probably not one of his other letters here. Probably a prior letter of welcome. I wrote a letter of welcome to the church, but Diotrephes. Everybody say Diotrephes. Now that guy. Diotrephes. I was asked how to sign this earlier, and I don't have a clue. She didn't really ask me. Who likes to put himself first. There are six things we know about Diotrephes, but notice the first one. Diotrephes, he likes to put himself first. Pastor Jerry, you ever see this in traffic? People who like to put themselves first. Diotrephes likes himself first. He does not acknowledge our authority. He's talking wicked nonsense about us. He refuses to welcome the brothers. He stops those who want to welcome the brothers. He puts them out of the church. Worse than not wanting to do good himself, he interferes with those who do want to do good. And it's all rooted in the fact that Diotrephes wants to put himself first. Do you see the similarity, though, to 2 John? He wants to go out on ahead. Diotrephes is one of these people who says, it's about me. It's me. It has to be mine. Some of the greatest mistakes we ever make in the Christian life come out of our need for personal significance. It needs to be my ministry. It needs to be my thing that I'm involved in. You know, they don't talk about it enough on Sunday morning. The church doesn't support it enough. How many times have you ever heard somebody say, you know, churches don't talk enough about this, somebody says. Pastors aren't supportive enough of fill in the blank. We hear a lot of people who want to be first. We hear a lot of people who are upset that anybody's paying attention to anything else. I'll tell you, one guy told me, nobody's doing the kind of missions we're doing, he told me once. You got to be first. That's your first sign that something's going wrong. People who go out on ahead, who think they don't need the church, who think that the church is optional. I don't know. You know, I don't really need the church. I've gone out on ahead of that. I need to be first. Diotrephes loves to be first. It's interesting that John never attributes to this guy a leadership position. He doesn't call him a bishop or an elder. He just talks about a guy who apparently has sort of usurped authority. Because he's not only not doing the things that Gaius is doing, he's trying to kick people out of the church who are. And this might explain to us why John writes a lengthy letter like this encouraging Gaius. Shortest book of the Bible, but lengthy in the sense that it's a lot more than just saying, hey, Demetrius is a good dude. You can welcome him. He says, I want to encourage you, probably because Gaius is pushing back on the pushback that Diotrephes gives. You can almost sense the conflict. In your church, it sounds like he's saying, Diotrephes pushes people out who do what you're doing. And Gaius is standing up to him with all of his worldly wealth, with all of his position, with all of his influence. He's saying, no, I will keep welcoming people who teach the truth. And John is saying, keep up the great work. Diotrephes likes to be first. He's talking wicked nonsense. But if I come, John is at the age now where he has to say if I come, I will bring up what he's doing. I'm with you, he says. He rejects our authority. John brings Gaius into this. He says, you're not just speaking for yourself when you stand up against Diotrephes. You're speaking for the apostles. You're speaking for the church. You're the one who's doing the right thing. And don't worry about it. God is not confused about who's right and who's wrong. He refuses to welcome the brothers. That shouldn't stop you, he's saying. In verse 11, he says, beloved, do not imitate evil, but imitate good. Keep adding water to the soup, he says. Don't imitate the evil things that you see others doing. Don't be like Diotrephes. Don't be like that guy. Have people be like you. Imitate what is good and set an example for others. Whoever does good is from God. Whoever does evil has not seen God. Now, this is a very John thing to say. He talks a lot about those who have seen God and those who have not seen God. He emphasizes here, it's pretty easy to know when somebody hasn't really seen a picture of Christ. When you see Christ, you want to be more like him. I think it's really powerful that he talks about wanting to be first because John went through his own bout of wanting to be first. You may remember it was John, his brother, who went to Jesus and said, hey, when you're in your kingdom, which of us sits at your right and which at your left, right? And Jesus says, you idiots, that's not how this works. The sons of thunder, Jesus called them, because they were sort of always a little bit full of it. Okay? Remember, it was James and John who went to Jesus and said, hey, that city that doesn't want to welcome us, you want us to call down fire and destroy them? And Jesus says, no, that's not what I want you to do. And also, if I need to call down a fire on anybody, I won't be needing your help, I imagine. James and John, though, wanted to be first. They wanted to be something. It was a lifetime of walking with Jesus that taught him not to need to be first. Think about the teachings of his first teacher, John the Baptist, who said, now I must decrease while he increases. It's John the Baptist who said, oh, other people are leaving me and following him. Good. That's the whole idea. John at this point sort of just knows. He says, Diotrephes needs to be first. But when you've walked with God as long as I have, you know that there's really not much in that. Don't imitate what is evil, imitate what is good, because those who do what is evil have not seen God. When you've seen a picture of Jesus, you don't need to be first anymore. When you've seen Jesus wash your own dirty, disgusting feet, it's hard to keep wanting to be first. Demetrius has received a good testimony from everyone and from the truth itself. What a statement. The guy you're going to be hosting in your home, he has actually got a good reputation, not just with other believers, but with the truth himself, with God, I think. Demetrius has earned a reputation with the truth. Just something to dwell on. We also add our testimony, and you know our testimony is true. Notice that he once again is doing the sort of the triune thing. He's got a good testimony with everyone and from the truth and now from us also. You can welcome this guy. You can be confident that he's a good dude. Well, he closes it out with this, and in both letters, it's largely the same. I had much to write to you in 3 John, he says, but I would rather not write with pen and ink. I hope to see you soon and we will talk face to face. This is similar to 2 John where he says, I have much to write to you, but I'd rather not use paper and ink. I'd rather come and talk face to face that our joy may be complete. John does what you often see in the text message. We'll talk about it in person. I can't wait to talk more about these things with you. I don't think these are accidents that the Bible gives us these things. We shouldn't sit here with regret and say, boy, I wish he'd written a longer letter. I'd love to know what they talked about when they got together. The point of this verse is John reminding us that the true purpose of the church is here. It's to be here face to face and together. The purpose of the church is not just to passively receive written information. You can't get along with Christ by just sucking in the information. You have to be in communion with the people. There's no other way to do it. Peace be to you. The friends greet you. Greet the friends each by name, and the children of your elect sister greet you. I like these two endings because they do exactly what he warns not doing for those who are wicked. Don't greet the heretics, remember he said, because by doing so you take part in their wicked works. But both of these letters end with him telling them, greet one another. Greet one another. Be in communion with one another. Be in fellowship with one another. Many of you are probably hosting this week. You were doing a little bit of what Gaius was doing. You had people in your home. Maybe some of them you didn't want there. Maybe you wish you could do what the chosen lady did and kick a few of them out. But you had family, you had friends. Think about what happens when people are just in your home. They're just around. Think about the kind of conversations you get to have that you can't really plan. John says you're going to benefit from Demetrius, him being in your home and the conversations you're going to get into. But more than that, I can't wait for us as a church to be together because the same thing happens. Unplanned fellowship is part of the church. Our interactions with each other when we're out in the lobby and we just start talking about whatever, the things that we discuss, this is part of what the church is all about. And in some of the final letters John will ever write, he says, I can't wait to be there in person with you. Well, I want to give you a couple of quick takeaways from this book because I know we've sort of run through them, but just a few things to dwell on as you walk out of here. One, the incarnation is the center of our faith. Somebody asks you, what's Christianity all about? It's a lot of places you feel like you could start. But he says you can do worse than starting right where Jesus is born. Jesus coming into earth to die for us. The incarnation is what our faith is all about. Another is don't try to be first. Try to find someone to serve. Gaius is remembered in history. He's got a whole book of the Bible dedicated to himself because he was welcoming people, feeding them, helping with their problems, and getting them on their way. Gaius wasn't apparently a preacher, a teacher. He wasn't some great man. He's somebody that any generation of the church could have produced and has produced. He's just a man who knew how to support good things when he saw them going on. Third, don't feed the trolls. I should say heretics, but the people who are out there who are denying Christ, don't support them, don't help them, don't aid them, don't follow them on Instagram, don't give them your voice, Don't give them anything to work with. Cut off the oxygen, John would tell us, to those who deny the teaching of Christ. Fourth, there's nothing small in God's kingdom. I think it's really powerful that the smallest book of the Bible teaches us that sometimes it's the smallest things that make the big difference. Gaius's small little contribution to the kingdom of God was important, even if he didn't understand why. It was easy for him to throw his hands up and say, I don't know, I just feed these people. What am I doing? Diotrephes is trying to get me out of the church. People are giving me a hard time. This is hurting me in the community. It's hurting me financially. And John says, keep doing it. Because if it feels small to you and it's making the devil mad, that should be an indication that your measure of it might be wrong. The small things we do for the kingdom of God are what matter. Finally, see us in person and greet us by name. As we head into a new year, stay involved in your church. Don't quit your church. Don't walk out the door and say, I don't need this. Be more involved. Find ways to love one another. Find ways to be hospitable, because that's what we're commanded to do in the scriptures. I'll pray for us as we close. God, we thank you for your word, and we thank you that even in short books, you have things to teach us. We thank you that every word of the scriptures matter. I pray that you'd help us this year to love your church, to support what is good, and to cut off what is evil. I pray that you'd give us the strength to do what's right and give us wisdom as we head into a new year. In Jesus' name.